Okay, today I'm going to be talking about the Berlin Crisis. Actually, the first part of the Berlin Crisis, which is the Eisenhower phase, the part that goes from November 1958, essentially, to the end of 1960. What's the point of talking in great detail about a crisis? Is it just that crises are intrinsically interesting? Because by definition, a crisis means a period in which there's a fairly high perceived risk of war. And during this period, we're talking about a general nuclear war. More megatonnage in place in 1960 than there had been up to that point or there would be subsequently. This is a war that broke out in 1960, a general nuclear war would have been an unimaginable catastrophe, by far the worst thing that would have happened in the whole history of the human race. So crises are intrinsically interesting because there's that specter of a nuclear holocaust in the background. But that's not going to be our focus, and that's not going to be why we're going to be focusing in very great detail on this crisis, the Great Berlin Crisis, which I've mentioned this a number of times, and it's an important point. We'll see it in the next lecture, I think. A crisis of which the Cuban Missile Crisis was an integral part. As a matter of fact, the Cuban Missile Crisis was the climactic phase of the Great Berlin Crisis. Why are we interested in crisis? Because of their role in the larger story. People think of crises, oh, they're just things that happen out of the blue. Like, you know, summer thunderstorm just kind of happens, runs its course, very dramatic, all kinds of thunder and lightning, and then it disappears. Things go on as they had been. That's a profoundly misleading notion of what crises are about and why they're important. They're important because they're not separate from the main story. They're part and parcel of the main story. They're an integral part of the main story of international in terms of their causes, in terms of the way they run their course, and in terms of their consequences. Now, I don't know how many of you in Poli Sci 20 or some other course like that were exposed to the ideas of this guy Jeffrey Blaney or James Fearon. Blaney was actually a historian. He was an Australian historian. He wrote a very interesting book called The Causes of War. Blaney's basic insight, his basic argument there in that book, was that, to use his own phrase, he says, wars are essentially a dispute about the measurement of power. If both sides agreed about what the balance of power actually was, if both sides understood power realities for what they actually were, then they would frame their policies accordingly. Those policies would be in harmony with the underlying balance of power, and thus they'd be in harmony with each other. They'd be able to reach some sort of accommodation. So if you have a war, it can only be, and this is the Blaney argument, it can only be because countries don't agree on these things. Some countries think that they're stronger than they actually are. Maybe both sides in a conflict are overly optimistic about what their chances would be if war actually broke out. Right? You know, very interesting concept. And James Fearon, who's a very prominent contemporary American political scientist, he's at Stanford University, he wrote an extremely influential article called Rational Explanations for War, and I don't know, it came out around 1995 or so. And he basically took that central Blaney inside, and he ran with it and imposed a kind of more rationalistic structure on that sort of argument. But Blaney didn't just stop there with that argument about what caused war. His whole notion was that if there are these misunderstandings about what the balance of power actually is, those misunderstandings are actually cleared up when a war actually breaks out. You think of the First World War, for example. Maybe both the Entente and the Central Powers thought that they were stronger than they actually were, thought their chances of winning the war were better than they actually were. But very soon the war bogged down into a stalemate, and it became clear what the real balance of power was, that these two sides were of approximately equal power. So the fact that war reveals that, you know, means that now countries are in a position to reach an understanding based on their clear sense for those power realities. And I guess that's why, a peace that results from a war, you know, it can last for a while. This is what Blaney says. For our purposes today, the important point to draw away, to take away from this whole line of argument is that this is not just an argument about war, it's also an argument about crisis, or it can be extended to apply to crises like the Berlin crisis. Right? There are these tests of strength. Different countries have different ideas about how far they could push things. They don't know how much resistance they're going to encounter on the part of the other side. A crisis is a test of strength, the same way a war is. It reveals what the true power relationship is, and thus plays a major role in clarifying things. It plays a stabilizing role. A positive role, right? You have to say, you just apply this way of looking at things, so you get these kind of counterintuitive results. Crises aren't necessarily just purely bad things that are to be avoided at all costs. They have a function to play. Okay, in the case of the Berlin crisis, that had a function in forcing countries to think through what their real aims were, how far they were willing to go in terms of risking war in order to stand up for their most basic interests. Right? If it's revealed, for example, that the West is willing in the final analysis to go to war for the sake of Berlin, well, that's an important fact that from that point on is going to have an important impact on Soviet policy, that sort of thing. Right? So we're interested in the Berlin crisis as an integral part of the story, part and parcel of the larger story, not just this isolated event, in terms of its causes, in terms of its consequences. And in fact, as I understand the whole history of the Cold War, the Berlin crisis is the central episode in the entire story of the Cold War. All these tensions come to a head. The different policies are tested, and ultimately, from that cauldron, from that crucible of a highly intense crisis, a stable system emerges. After the Berlin crisis comes to head, with the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 1962, the rudiments of a stable international order are, in fact, hammered out. They come into being. That's the framework for our understanding in the next few lectures. Okay, so what's the basic story? It begins with the Khrushchev so-called ultimatum of November of 1958. What was the Khrushchev ultimatum? Khrushchev, of course, was the Soviet leader at this time, Nikita Khrushchev. Don't forget when you spell it to remember that the way the name is transliterated in English, three H's. Okay. He gives this speech and then sends these notes to the Western powers. He says, the basic argument is, the whole situation of Berlin, of Berlin being divided, the three western sectors of Berlin being garrisoned by Western troops and therefore under the military protection of the Western powers. This is a remnant of the occupation regime. It's a remnant of the war. It's over more than a dozen years have gone by since the end of the war. Time has come to draw a line under the war and to have a more stable system. So the Soviets want to do this, Khrushchev says, in conjunction with the Western powers. But if the Western powers are unwilling to go along, they're going to do it themselves, and they're going to sign a peace treaty. A peace treaty with East Germany, their communist puppet states that they set up in the Soviet zone of Germany. Okay? And when the peace treaty is signed, at that point the occupation regime will end, because that's what a peace treaty does. And when the occupation regime ends, naturally the rights of the three Western powers and West Berlin will be liquidated. And if the Western powers have the audacity to try and maintain their rights through the use of force, then the East Germans will certainly resist. And if the East Germans resist, the Soviets will rise in defense of their East German ally. Right? So Khrushchev is basically threatening war. This is a threat of war. He's going to say, and he says, well, we're not going to insist on totally taking over West Berlin. The Western powers are going to have to leave. The Western troops are going to have to leave. But as an accommodation, as a great concession to the West, we're willing to make Berlin into a free city and guarantee the continuation of its present social and economic system. Okay? But we'll give the Western powers six months to negotiate these new arrangements. And if at the end of that six-month period we don't have anything viable, then we're going to proceed with a peace treaty, unilaterally liquidate the rights of the Western powers, and then if the West tries to maintain those rights, it means war. Right? So that's the Soviet ultimatum. People call it an ultimatum because of the six-month deadline. What was the USSR up to? Why did Khrushchev do this? Well, this is not the easiest question to resolve, because we still don't have really adequate evidence on Soviet policymaking during this period, on what was going on in Khrushchev's mind. But you can say a lot more than zero, partly by analyzing things in terms of the evidence, but also partly by bringing a theory of how international politics works to bear. What are the sorts of things that countries are willing to risk war over, especially to risk a general war or humiliation over? It has to be serious. It can't be done for frivolous reasons. Core national interests have to be at stake. And that's a set of theoretical conceptions that serve as a lens through which, you're trying to make sense of these events. Okay? What were the Soviets up to? Okay? They certainly didn't want war with the West. I mean, first of all, if they did want war with the West, what was the sense of giving the West 6 months lead time to prepare for it? See, Soviets wouldn't want war with the West given what the military balance was. The United States still enjoys some good measure of nuclear superiority. And I should say again, I think I mentioned this. Mentioned this in class. This was not because the Soviets had been physically or economically or technologically incapable of building up sorts of nuclear forces that would survive an American attack and then go on to retaliate and destroy the United States as a functioning society. You don't need too many survivable, deliverable weapons for that to be the case. These thermonuclear explosives are so incredibly powerful that you don't need to deliver that many of them on target to utterly destroy your adversary as a functioning society. Something like 40 or 50 weapons would do it, even in the case of really huge countries like the United States and the Soviet Union, in the case of the European countries like West Germany, Britain, and so on. It would be more like 3 or 4. So it wasn't as though the Soviets were incapable of doing that. But they didn't do it. And this was profoundly puzzling to the American analysts, above all here at the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica, who had this data and were trying to make sense of it. It's like the Soviets were sitting ducks. They did not mate the warheads to the delivery systems. The warheads were under the control of the KGB. The delivery systems were under the control of the military. On the average, they were like 50 miles away from each other. The Soviets, deployed their weapons close to their frontier so that they wouldn't have much in the way. The result was they wouldn't have much in the way of warning time. You look at all these problems with the way the Soviets structured their forces and the way they wasted money on junk like anti-aircraft artillery when we had planes that would fly much higher than their air defense forces could reach. It just didn't make sense to the American analysts who were trying to grapple with this. And as they grappled with this problem, they were led to think about it in terms of the balance of power within the Soviet national security establishment. The power of the part of the Soviet military that was concerned with air defense was extraordinarily great. And because this was such a striking example of an anomaly, it served as the basis for a whole larger body of thought which came to be called the bureaucratic politics paradigm. State behavior is not to be understood in rational terms. State behavior is distorted by the imperatives linked to the kind of bureaucratic system that generated it. Because everything that's done has to be done through a bureaucracy, and the different elements in the bureaucracy have their own distinct bureaucratic interests. And we saw how historians, some of them, bought into these conceptions and in fact developed them in certain areas, like the Utley argument that you read for this course, the Utley book. That was very clearly a bureaucratic politics argument linked to this whole way of thinking. Did you have your hand up?
Yeah. I was wondering what exactly would an Air Force defense system entail, like an air defense?
Air defense?
Yeah.
Air defense? It's like just whatever you need in order to shoot down the bombers that are attacking you, right? So you're defending against air attack, not missile attack, because the missiles go higher than the atmosphere. And so, but here we're talking about just aircraft, basically manned bombers, but also these kind of unmanned cruise missiles that came on the scene later that go through the atmosphere and will you be able to kind of shoot them down? And so it entails identifying these things with radars and so on, and then having forces that are able to kind of target them and destroy them. And those forces could be, ground-based artillery, it could be ground-based missiles, it could be aircraft armed with air-to-air missiles and so on. But it's a complicated system, and the first major instance of the application of computers for computers to be the heart of a military system was the SAGE air defense system that was deployed by the United States in the early 1950s. The Soviets had nothing like this. It's like a very porous air defense.
Okay.
What are the Soviets up to? They don't want war. They're in no position to fight a war. They really are very weak in military terms. You know, the United States still has a first strike capability here. If we attack hard enough and fast enough, the Soviets aren't going to be able to do any really heavy damage to us. They might not even be able to hurt our European allies if we move fast enough. And the Eisenhower strategy is a first strike strategy. You have to realize this. My friend David Rosenberg, who was the first really to analyze all of these issues, says, people call the Eisenhower strategy massive retaliation. That was one of these catch terms that people used at the time to kind of capture the idea that the American attack would be absolutely massive, no holds barred, you know, nothing held in reserve. Massive retaliation. He says massive retaliation really was massive preemption. You know, key insight into the whole Eisenhower strategy. So the Soviets, and we now know that they understood all of these things. The Soviets were in no position to bring matters close to the point of war. You know, the whole, and that suggests that the goal was not, if it wasn't war, well, what could it have been? Getting the Allies to negotiate, getting the Allies to take Soviet concerns seriously. Okay. Wasn't war. Well, maybe a lot of people think, oh, the goal is to force the Allied powers out of Berlin. Say, well, why would they want to do that? Our presence in Berlin is not a source of strength for us. It's our Achilles heel. Here's Berlin, West Berlin. It's this land island. It's in the middle of communist East Germany. It's over 100 miles from the West German border. It's like, how on earth can you maintain such an exposed salient as that? Well, by threatening to go nuclear. But would you really be willing to do that once the other side acquires the ability to retaliate against you, no matter how hard and how fast you strike? Right, this and Eisenhower. Don't forget, you have to remember, Eisenhower's a military man. He sees the world through the eyes of a general. He doesn't like Berlin. He doesn't like the idea of an exposed salient like that. You say, and he is constantly complaining to his close collaborators about how this whole situation, he says, is a can of worms. I warned President Roosevelt, during the war, not to kind of, create the situation where we're exposed in Berlin like that. But Roosevelt just ignored me, and he said, "Oh, I can get along with Uncle Joe," which is the way Stalin was referred to a lot of the time during the war, kindly Uncle Joe. So Eisenhower Eisenhower knew this is our Achilles heel, a source of weakness. Soviets are bound to see that. Why would they gratuitously want to change that? Maybe to inflict a humiliation on the United States, that the Americans, rather than go to war, were forced to withdraw from Berlin. But given the military balance at this point, and given kind of what was at stake in terms of prestige for the Americans, if the Soviets pushed things to that point, if push came to shove, and the world entered into a really sharp crisis where the risk of war was very high, then it would almost certainly be the Soviets who would be humiliated, who would have to capitulate, who would have to kind of walk away from this thing with their tail between their legs. And it's like, that's not rational. You can't imagine that the Soviets would want that. And in any event, if they wanted to take over Berlin, there were much easier and less risky ways for them to do it. Because whereas we had the right, which we took very seriously, to send military forces across East German territory into West Berlin, we had the right, deriving from our right to be present there militarily, to supply the forces that we had there. We did not really have the same right to guarantee civilian intercourse between West Berlin and West Germany, normal economic relations between West Berlin and West Germany. If the Soviets and the East Germans blocked that, but respected our rights to supply our military garrison there, and limited their interference to civilian traffic, well, we weren't going to do anything about it. We would accept it. And Eisenhower, actually, one of his big arguments was the Soviets have the ability to make our position in West Berlin untenable because West Berlin was totally isolated and didn't have any economic relations with West Germany. Then the whole situation in West Berlin would no longer be viable economically. People would move out of the city, it would wither on the vine, and so on. Eisenhower, this is a big argument for a negotiated settlement. But what it shows is that if the Soviets were serious about weakening the Western position in Berlin, they had these much less risky ways of doing these things. Similarly, they could have sealed off the border between East Berlin and West Berlin, something which they did in August 1961, as you all know, constructing the famous Berlin Wall. They could have done that in the late 50s. The Americans made it clear that our interest was in maintenance of the status quo in West Berlin, but what the Soviets did in the East, well, that was essentially their business. We weren't going to go to war over this stuff. Not a vital interest for us. And the East Germans were pushing the Soviets to do that. See, seal the border. In large part because there was this big refugee flow from East Germany to West Germany via Berlin. You can just take the subway from East Berlin to West Berlin, and then once you're in West Berlin, you go to the airport and you fly to the west. And who were the ones who were leaving East Germany? Well, it was the young people, skilled people who could make much more money in the west, whereas the less productive elements of the population, old age pensioners and so on, they would stay in the east because the social services there were quite good. And so East Germany was being bled of its most productive and most valuable citizens. So the East Germans wanted to close the border. The Soviets said no. And why did they say no? Because they say, well, the West won't tolerate it? No, that was not the argument they made. Well, this stuff we know because the former East German archives have been studied, and there's a very nice book by Hope Harrison that deals with these issues. And basically the Soviets said, we don't want to do that because Berlin's not the problem. We have bigger fish to fry. We want to keep this Berlin problem with refugees and so on alive because it gives us, it's an important bargaining chip for us vis-a-vis the Western powers. Right? So that's the real goal, to put pressure on the Western powers. It's the rights of the Western powers that are being threatened because it's the Western powers that are the target of the Soviet policy. And what is their concern? Well, what does their concern have to be? It has to be something that's affecting their core political interests. And again, this is very similar to 1948. It's the prospect of a resurgence of German power. Just as in 1948, Soviets are alarmed at this whole idea that the West is moving ahead without them in constructing a West German state, a state directed against them. So in 1958, what's going on in Germany, West Germany, is also bound to be a source of great concern to the Soviets. And what's going on in West Germany that could possibly touch their most basic security interests? It's the prospect of West Germany being armed with nuclear weapons, with American nuclear weapons. This is the connection between all everything that I was talking about in previous lectures about the nuclear sharing policy of the Eisenhower administration, the whole business with MC-48, one and only one way in which Europe could be defended, that's by nuclear-based defense, and the implication there is that all the NATO allies should be should have forces that are geared to that strategy, which is, say, forces that are effectively armed with nuclear weapons. Well, you may say, the Germans would never, yeah?
I want to
Thanks. You may say, well, the Germans had no interest in nuclear weapons. See, the Germans knew that the world would never tolerate this, and they didn't want to do this anyway because they knew that they had to kind of make amends for their militaristic past. They had to kind of prove to the world that they had turned over a new leaf. They weren't going to kind of go that route. And that's an argument that was very commonly made, in large part because given the course that events were to take in the 1960s, a course of events that had as its consequence the inability of the Germans to develop a nuclear capability. There was an interest on all sides in saying, oh, this was never an issue. It was the Germans could say, oh, we never wanted to go in that route ever. So the fact that their own allies pretty much had to force them to accept a non-nuclear status, well, they didn't. No interest in publicizing that fact, and the Western powers, especially the United States, had no interest in making it clear to the whole world how serious this issue was and how much pressure had to be put on the Germans to keep them from going that route. So the information about this subject was carefully controlled politically, and people got the impression that, oh no, the Germans never wanted this. It turns out it's just not true at all. I mean, for me, this is a big surprise. The evidence is absolutely unambiguous. Konrad Adenauer, the German chancellor, founding chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany, chancellor from 1949, when the Federal Republic was founded, until 1963, when, as we'll see, when he was forced from power by the Americans. Adenauer, in the 1950s, very much wanted Germany to develop a nuclear capability. Say, if Germany wouldn't be a real state if it weren't able to defend itself. And the only way you could defend itself against a great nuclear power like the Soviet Union was by having nuclear forces under your own control. And you couldn't, because you couldn't in the long run rely on the Americans to do it, because once the Soviets developed survivable forces, the Americans would be very reluctant to order nuclear escalation. Well, maybe Eisenhower would do it. So Eisenhower was a general, and there's this kind of soldierly ethic of death before dishonor. Eisenhower believed in that sort of thing. But more normal American presidents, after the strategic balance had shifted, they're not going to want to put American cities at risk in order to provide for the defense of Western Europe. Extended deterrence is not viable in the long run. Only direct deterrence works. And this is a perfectly normal, legitimate sort of political calculation. There's nothing wrong with the Germans aspiring to have a nuclear capability. They want it for purely defensive purposes, or essentially defensive purposes. Right? Even though it's bound to be viewed by the Soviets as a threat. How do we notice? Well, Adenauer tells this to his top associates. I think 1956, there was a German cabinet meeting. All this stuff is available online, by the way, now. Right, the records of the German cabinet are available on the website of the German National Archives. Eisenhower says about nuclear weapons, we must produce them. Wir müssen sie produzieren, if you know German. We have to produce them. He thinks Euratom is going to give Germany a way to develop nuclear capability. He wants to work with the French in the waning days of the Fourth Republic in early 1958. There's this whole set of arrangements where France, Italy, and Germany would work together to develop an independent nuclear capability. Something which the Americans, by the way, were willing to support and cooperate with. He knows the rest of the world doesn't like this idea. The rest of the world, including his own allies, kind of, at least in France and Britain, small countries in continental Western Europe kind of are opposed to this. But he feels like, you know, Germany's going to have to pay a price for her Nazi past and so on. He knows all these things, but he wants to make sure that the door is not closed on a German nuclear force forever, because Germany needs this for essentially defensive purposes. Great nation can't be so totally dependent on another major power for protection, especially power like the United States, based an ocean away. And especially in the nuclear age, when threat of nuclear escalation is becoming increasingly threadbare as both sides build survivable nuclear forces. Okay. So the Soviets know these things. What can we presume that they know them? Because it's very easy for the Soviets, dominating East Germany as it is, to penetrate West German intelligence. You just get these East Germans, as I say, take the subway to from one part of Berlin to the other. You know, once they're in West Berlin and move to West Germany, they have West German citizenship automatically. They can insinuate themselves into the German national security establishment the same way anyone else could. It's like, you know, it's like West Germany penetrated by Soviet intelligence. Also NATO penetrated by Soviet intelligence. And all this stuff is kind of known. Returning to these points. Oh, well, because technically what Germany agreed to in the Paris Accords was that she would not build nuclear weapons on her own territory. But she could build them on other people's territory, and she could buy nuclear weapons that were built, say, by the United States and simply sold to Germany. So there are ways of getting around the Paris Accords. And then Adenauer had this whole theory, this legal principle of rebus sic stantibus, which means these legal agreements are binding only as long as the basic context remains the same. If things change, then these legal understandings have to be renegotiated. So he claimed that the Americans basically interpreted the Paris Accords in that context. And of course, then the Americans were not unsympathetic to these things. The whole Eisenhower notion was that the Europeans should be armed with nuclear weapons. It was a contentious issue within the American national security establishment during the Eisenhower period, because a lot of people, you know, they remembered World War II, still fresh in people's minds, saying, you know, it was only barely a decade earlier it ended. And they didn't like the idea of the Germans being entrusted with this enormous power, something peculiar about the Germans, look at our whole experience with them, we don't want to do this. They were leery of that. But Eisenhower just dismissed all of that. And his argumentation is actually quite interesting, because it shows the degree to which a realist approach to international politics shapes policy, even in a country as ideological as the United States. And Eisenhower's notion was, and this is how he dealt with those objections, he said, well, yes, Germany was a problem in the past, but that was only because Russia was weak. Now that Russia is strong, I'll take a strong Germany, meaning a nuclear Germany. You know, it's like, it's not a question of national character. Power has its own logic. Let's just think of this stuff in pure power political terms. Very interesting, because the great myth in those days was that American policy was excessively ideological, the Americans were incapable of thinking in power political terms, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So putting all these things together, it seems to me quite clear that that's what the Soviets grasped how serious this business was, and they had tried heading it off with a softer policy, the whole idea of championing nuclear-free zones in Central Europe, and now they've thought, like, well, that didn't work, so tougher measures are in order. Somewhat speculative, but it's the only interpretation that makes sense to me. So how does the West react? the Eisenhower policy, firm but not truculent, he said. We want to be firm. We're not going to allow the other side, through its threats, to kick us out of Berlin. We're not going to leave Berlin with our tail between our legs, because that would have enormous, wide-ranging repercussions for our position in the world. The West Germans would lose faith in us because we had made such a big deal about our right to be in Berlin and that we would do whatever it took to maintain those rights. And if we pulled out now, the West Germans would lose faith in us, the whole NATO system would collapse, people would realize the United States was a paper tiger, that its commitments, its promises counted for nothing, and so on. We were not going to be humiliated like that. We were not going to be treated that way. There was no need for us to be treated that way because we were so strong. Push came to shove, you know, we could put the knife to their throats, they would give way. Yeah. That's the Eisenhower policy. That's the firmness of the Eisenhower policy. You know, in the final analysis, Eisenhower is willing to go to nuclear war over this issue. Now, this is a very important point because there's a big debate among people interested in these things, political scientists and others concerned with, strategic matters, about the usability of nuclear weapons, the role that nuclear weapons play in international politics. And a lot of people think that these things, they're good for one and only one thing. That's deterrence, right? They're good for deterring the other side from using them. Maybe they have a more general deterrent effect. But you can't ever use these things. It's utter nonsense to think that these things can be used. And, the leading political scientists, leading international relations theorists, people like Kenneth Waltz makes that sort of argument. He says, did our own big words or the Soviet Union's prattling about nuclear war fighting ever mean anything? He says, no, because they would never do it. Never do it. Never, and they certainly would never launch an all-out nuclear attack. It's absurd. And that sort of argument underpinned a lot of what they had to say about what U.S. policy should be. We shouldn't get so concerned about countries like Iraq and Iran and Libya, North Korea and so on, developing these small nuclear capabilities. They're good only for deterrence. They'll never actually be used. So the American government shouldn't be so upset about this stuff. That's the Waltz argument. How do you get to the bottom of that kind of argument? One and only one way. And that's by looking at the historical evidence and see whether these people, like during the Eisenhower administration, were serious. When is their seriousness tested? It's tested in the context of a crisis. What will we do if push comes to shove? You have to consider these issues. You can't just improvise in the event. And Eisenhower makes it quite clear that we will take certain measures. The great myth was Eisenhower, all he had was this massive retaliation capability. The only thing in the American arsenal was to launch an all-out nuclear attack. We had essentially nothing but that. You see this caricature of the Eisenhower policy all the time. In the Kennedy administration, for example, the Kennedy Secretary of State Rusk, he was talking about the Eisenhower policy. The Eisenhower policy for the defense of Berlin is we send a couple of jeeps down the Autobahn, basically a platoon, very small military unit, and if the East Germans turn them back, then the balloon goes up, it's execute the PSYOP, that's the basic plan for general nuclear war, and the entire Eastern Bloc is a smoking, radiating ruin, to use one of the documents from that period. It's just not true. That was not what the Eisenhower strategy was. It was a strategy of controlled escalation. Yeah, you'd start out with a small platoon-level probe, and if that's turned back, then you go up a bit more to a battalion, and eventually up to a full reinforced division, which is a serious force. And if And if the Soviet side, the communist side, fires on that force and prevents it from achieving its objectives, that means that the Soviets have decided consciously to raise the ante and run the risk of a war with the United States. That being the case, if we're, you know, given that we're not going to surrender over Berlin, then we execute the PSYOP. Then we go to World War III. But not until we've taken those preliminary steps. And the assumption was the Soviets, knowing that that was the American attitude, in part through their espionage channels and NATO especially, knowing that that was the American attitude, they wouldn't dare. They wouldn't dare attack that force. They wouldn't dare, you know, run the risk of a third world war. They were bound to fall back. That was the American policy. How did our European allies react to that? For Eisenhower does not feel like the United States, despite its vast strength, can simply lay down the law to the European allies. Okay? We have to work out some sort of consensus. We have to kind of get everyone on board, because we don't want the Europeans to complain about us and say, oh, look how reckless the Americans are. Or on the other hand, if the Americans don't take a tough line, look how weak the Americans are. We want to kind of co-opt them into a common strategy, because these are very difficult issues, and these enormous risks, these choices that could lead to a third world war, these have to be made on a joint basis. So Eisenhower puts a great premium on working with the Europeans. And we'll see, this is one of the big differences between the Eisenhower Berlin strategy and the strategy of the Kennedy period. And there's this big problem. Well, I'll begin by just talking about the British, then we'll break off because I'm kind of out of time. The British, they don't want. They don't like the Eisenhower strategy at all. They don't like the idea of going to war in the final analysis for the sake of Berlin, war which would be suicidal for them, they're convinced. And especially for the sake of the Germans. You know, the British had fought the Germans twice in the course of the century. So I remember there was this one editorial in a British newspaper from this period when all these issues were being discussed, you know, should we go to war for the sake of Berlin? And Macmillan, the British Prime Minister, was kind of against it. This editorial said, and he was attacked by the Germans for taking a line that was felt verged on appeasement. And so this newspaper said, well, the Germans are our allies now. Nobody doubts that. But after all that's happened in this century, Dr. Adenauer could hardly expect us to love them. All right, so that was the British attitude. Macmillan tries to make himself into the honest broker. He flies off to Moscow in March of 1959 to meet with Khrushchev and try and work things out. Macmillan is kind of humiliated. His allies, you know, are just really put off by this. The Americans' view Macmillan is close to an appeaser. The Germans really dislike this British strategy. Right? That's the British. I'll end now with that, and we'll pick up next time with the Germans and then the French.